Welcome to the May 2025 News Bulletin podcast for commercial shipping marine surveyors, put together by the International Institute of Marine Surveying. We open our podcast with an introduction from IIAMS CEO Mike Schwartz. Dear colleague, often my monthly introduction column to this news bulletin is driven by the prevailing news at the time of writing and comments reaching my inbox. This month is no exception, only that in the past few weeks, there have been two far-reaching topics of conversation that have produced larger-than-normal reactions and much debate. The first is the UK government's exceptional call for evidence to decarbonise the UK's fleet of under 400 gross-ton vessels. I appreciate that IIAMS is an international organisation and our local wranglings in the UK may be of little interest to others in the world, but maybe this policy will reach other parts of the globe too. Also, I am conscious that the Institute is a non-political organisation, so I choose my words carefully. The UK government has launched a consultation which runs until the 25th of July 2025. More detailed information about the consultation follows my introduction. Already there have been loud voices of concern raised from various parts of the small boat sector, including the canal boat community, the fishing industry and charter sector amongst them, about the impracticalities of such new regulation. The ramifications could be huge, depending on the outcome of the consultation and the subsequent new regulation burden placed on the small boat market. On the 4th to the 5th of April, I had the pleasure of co-hosting the annual IIAMS Baltimore Conference. The event drew a good face-to-face audience with a number of others joining online, including some new faces. Once again, I applaud the efforts of James Randy Wren, IIAMS Regional Director US, for organizing the event and attracting some great speakers to ensure its success. Over the two-day event, delegates heard, amongst other topics, about the latest developments with lithium-ion batteries, new thinking on slamming hull shapes, why report writing software is making inroads, a humorous look at photos taken on survey that defy the imagination, plus much more. The second matter, my visit to America coincided with the announcement by President Trump of the new global tariffs. This news became the hot topic of conversation at the event, unsurprisingly. The instant reaction to the news from delegates was not favourable or encouraging. I have since been asked by many what impact the tariffs might have on the shipping and boating industry and specifically on the marine surveying sector. In truth, I simply do not know at this stage any more than you do. And by the time you read this column, no doubt things will have changed and moved on again as this is a fluid situation. But I have scouted around world media for initial reactions of relevance, although at this stage it is mostly speculation of course, which you can read in our news bulletin at iiams.org.uk/news-bulletins. I'd like to close out by reminding you of two great hybrid events organised by IIAMS taking place during May. If you are at the heavy commercial end of marine surveying, you are invited to join us on the 13th of May for Marine Surveyors, Peer Nightclubs, and Loss Prevention, Collaboration for Safer Seas. Open to all, either in person or online, the event is being broadcast live from the UK Peer Nightclubs offices in central London. More info can be found on our website. Don't miss this one, and the following week on the 20th of May, we are hosting the Festival of Knowledge X live from Amsterdam for the EC Mid-AVI community. Join us to celebrate the 10th anniversary since we launched the EC MID accreditation scheme back in May 2015. Full details about the program can be found at ecmidvesselinspectors.com/events. Survey well, Mike Schwartz. For our very first story of the month, the UK Marine Accident Investigation Branch has published a report into the deaths of three stevedores in a cargo hold access space on board the bulk carrier Berger Mawson. The incident took place at Bunyu Island Anchorage, Indonesia. On the 27th of June 2022, three unconscious stevedores were recovered from a cargo hold access space on board the Isle of Man registered bulk carrier Berger Mawson at Bunyu Island Anchorage, Indonesia. Despite prompt medical attention by ship and port staff, the three men died. Berger Mawson was loading a bulk cargo of coal from barges using a floating crane. The coal in cargo hold number 7 was being leveled by a bulldozer, when loading was paused and all hatches were closed due to heavy rain. Once the rain had stopped, a stevedore made several attempts to gain access to the bulldozer. Unsupervised, the stevedore mistakenly descended into cargo hold number 8 access space where he collapsed. As Berger Mawson's crew were collecting rescue equipment, two stevedores also collapsed in cargo hold number 8 access space as they attempted to rescue their stricken colleague. The MAIB investigation concluded that, The stevedores died because they entered an enclosed space that had a noxious atmosphere that could not sustain life. Atmosphere testing of cargo spaces was not routinely carried out before stevedores entered the compartments. The stevedores were not adequately supervised on board Berg & Mawson. Accessways to cargo spaces were not locked closed when not in use. The stevedores were unable to understand safety labels and warnings and cargo space identification. The agreed ship shore safety checklist had limited validity after the commencement of cargo operations. The terminal had not trained the stevedores in line with international guidelines on safe cargo work on board bulk carriers. An industry-led initiative that requires bulk terminals to implement safety training and management systems could improve stevedore safety on board vessels. You can read the full report at iams.org.uk/news. Our next report is called Recent Developments in Hatch Cover Testing, written by Mike Wall. In the 25 years since I first carried out a comparison of ultrasound hatch cover testing equipment in southern China, this method of hatch cover testing has become accepted as the go-to method. More and more shipping companies are using the equipment to check water tightness after loading and before sailing. It has also become the methodology required by P&I clubs during condition surveys. There are courses out there for marine surveyors to learn how to use the gear correctly, but there are still many who are ignorant of how it should be used to avoid misreadings. Briefly, the aim of the exercise is to fill the hold with high-frequency ultrasound by placing the generator in the middle of the lower hold. This ensures that a uniform signal is received at the hatch cover seals. By taking a reading with the hatch covers open, we obtain an open hatch, OH, value which is used as a datum. Any signal received less than the OH value during testing is taken as a percentage of the OH value. A plan view of the hatch cover showing the various readings around the side slash end and cross-channel seals is included in the final report. I have been monitoring hatch cover testing for many years and have to report some recent worrying developments of which I believe the P&I club should be aware. A technically correct bulk generator usually has a minimum of 13 transmitters giving a multi-directional signal. More recently, we have seen the development and marketing of smaller sets which are touted as the real deal. Some companies are offering an ultrasound generator with only 3 transmitters. The sound generated cannot possibly fill the hold of even the smallest bulk carrier. This smaller generator is also unidirectional and is therefore only suitable for confirming localized leaks. It has recently come to my attention that there is a lack of calibration of HC ultrasound testing equipment. It is understandable that the survey company is reluctant to have their US equipment out of commission for a couple of weeks whilst being calibrated in the UK, but the checks are essential to ensure that the equipment is operating correctly. I therefore believe that more comparison tests should be carried out. This would enable the international group of P&I clubs to issue an approved list of ultrasound equipment which is suitable for purpose. It would also provide an opportunity for them to issue rules relating to calibration. Calibration should always be carried out by the class-approved manufacturer with an appropriate certificate issued. It is unclear as to whether the P&I clubs are requesting copies of calibration certificates before using a marine survey company and their equipment. As these certificates are easily forged, it is suggested that the P&I club ship vetting executive should be asking the equipment manufacturer for a copy of the relevant calibration certificate. Mike Wall is the author of Hatch Covers, Operation, Testing and Maintenance, published by Witherby Seamanship International. For our next report, the Australian Maritime Safety Authority has highlighted the importance of effective risk assessment, especially for high-risk tasks. In some shipboard settings, unsafe practices can become the norm. This increases the likelihood of serious incidents. Risk assessment is an essential part of the vessel's safety management system under the International Safety Management Code. Understanding risks is only the first step. It's important to put safety measures in place to ensure safety. Failing to properly identify risks or apply controls can limit how effective a risk assessment is. Ship operators and crew must ensure safety procedures are not just documented, but actively followed and enforced. You can read more at amsa.gov.au. Up next, corrosion specialist Steel Paint, based in Germany, is calling for urgent action to address the significant environmental impact of steel corrosion, warning that inadequate corrosion protection is contributing more to global CO2 emissions than the entire aviation industry. With the maritime industries consuming an estimated 100 metres tons of steel annually, premature corrosion and subsequent steel renewal work is increasing carbon emissions dramatically, said Steel Paint's managing director Klaus Müller. Steel production remains one of the most carbon-intensive industrial processes. to produce a single 10 meters by 10 meters, 20 millimeters thick steel plate, for instance, emits about 3 tons of CO2. Factor in transportation costs and the need for additional coatings, and the carbon footprint looms large. This is underscored by a joint research study carried out by Curtin University and Ohio State University, which estimated that 25% of global steel production is lost to corrosion, with replacement and renewal accounting for 4-9% of total emissions globally. In our next story, the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board recommended that 30 owners of 68 bridges across 19 states conduct a vulnerability assessment to determine the risk of bridge collapse from a vessel collision. The NTSB found the Key Bridge, which collapsed after being struck by the container ship Dali on March 26, 2024, was almost 30 times above the acceptable risk threshold for critical or essential bridges, according to guidance established by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. Over the last year, the NTSB identified 68 bridges that were designed before the AASH to guidance was established, like the Key Bridge, that do not have a current vulnerability assessment. The recommendations are issued to bridge owners to calculate the annual frequency of collapse for their bridges using AASHTO's Method 2 calculation. This report does not suggest that the 68 bridges are certain to collapse. The NTSB is recommending that these 30 bridge owners evaluate whether the bridges are above the AASH to acceptable level of risk. The NTSB recommended that bridge owners develop and implement a comprehensive risk reduction plan if the calculations indicate a bridge has a risk level above the AASH to threshold. In 1991, AASH to developed and published the vulnerability assessment calculation for new bridges on the National Highway System, in response to the NTSB's investigation of the Sunshine Skyway bridge collapse in Florida. At the time, AASH to also recommended that all bridge owners conduct the vulnerability assessment on existing bridges to evaluate their risk of catastrophic collapse in the event of a vessel collision. AASH to reiterated that recommendation to states again in 2009. Since 1994, the Federal Highway Administration has required new bridges be designed to minimize the risk of a catastrophic bridge collapse from a vessel collision, given the size, speed, and other characteristics of vessels navigating the channel under the bridge. The Key Bridge was built before vulnerability assessments were required by FHWA. The NTSB found that had the Maryland Transportation Authority, or MDTA, conducted a vulnerability assessment on the Key Bridge based on recent vessel traffic, MDTA would have been aware that the Key Bridge was above the acceptable risk and would have had information to proactively reduce the bridge's risk of a collapse and loss of lives associated with a vessel collision with the bridge. You can read the full report at iimsusa.com. Next, flares manufactured in 2021 or earlier expire this year, as Transport Canada approves them for only 4 years. They should be replaced every third or fourth boating season. To dispose of expired flares, do not light them, throw them overboard, or add them to household garbage. Flares are not permitted in regular trash or at household hazardous waste facilities due to their potential explosion and fire hazards. Flares are only for emergencies, and lighting them in non-distress situations, like decommissioning, is illegal. Marine flares contain toxic chemicals, which can pollute waterways and drinking water sources. Up next, Lloyd's Register has issued an update to its retrofit research program, with the latest report focusing on the developments in engine retrofitting for alternative fuels. While the maritime industry has seen positive developments, such as increased methanol fuel conversions and shipyard retrofitting capabilities since 2023, the adoption of alternative fuels faces a significant hurdle. Regulatory pressures, such as the EU's Fuel EU Maritime and Emissions Trading System, are in place, yet the lack of robust incentives for fuel producers is slowing down the demand and overall transition. This disparity is creating a gap between regulatory push and market pull. The latest report leverages our in-depth data collected over the past year, highlighting the advancements, emerging trends, and current status of this rapidly evolving technology, which the shipping industry is actively exploring to decarbonize the existing fleet. You can request a copy of the report through the Lloyd's Register website. In our next story, the Australian Maritime Safety Authority has issued a safety alert, which aims to raise awareness of structural and stowage requirements for shipping containers and other CTRs in Australian ports. This is in response to an increase in improperly stowed CTRs and structural issues identified during inspection. Two recent incidents involve improperly packed CTRs, which led to catastrophic structural failures. These incidents highlight the critical need for ship and container owners, shippers and packers to understand their regulatory obligations and put effective controls in place. You can find out more Australian requirements for cargo, cargo packing, containers and more by visiting iamsaustralia.com.au. In our next segment, Scottish government-owned ferry agency SeaMAL has awarded a contract for 7 small electric ferries to Polish yard Remontowa, snubbing a bid from the Scottish government's own shipyard, Ferguson Marine. The decision leaves Ferguson without orders for new tonnage, except for a module construction contract for BAE Systems. Ferguson said that its bid led the tender on measurements of quality, but Remontowa won the contract on price. The two yards have been competitors in the same segment for years, and the loss could have an effect on Ferguson as it seeks to rebuild its order book. In a statement, SeaMAL said that it had to follow Scottish public procurement law, and Remontowa's bid came out on top under the tender formula. CMAL CEO Kevin Hobbs said in a statement, "We are confident in Remontowa's ability, and have worked with them before, most recently with the delivery of the MV Finnlagen in 2011. We will now enter a 10-day standstill period before finalising the contract." Scottish opposition politicians then slammed the award and said that it should have been handed to Ferguson directly, without a tender process. Ferguson's reputation for quality took a turn for the worse during the construction of SeaMAL's long-delayed LNG RoPax ferries, Glen Sannox and Glen Rosa. The project underwent multiple design changes and rounds of rework, and the costs forced Ferguson into administration in 2019. The Scottish government bought the yard out of bankruptcy and managed it through the completion of the two ferries. The project ended up 4 times over budget and 6 years behind schedule. Next, the Indian Directorate General of Shipping has published a notice installing closed-circuit television systems on Indian-flagged vessels and foreign-flagged vessels visiting Indian ports. The Merchant Shipping Notice sets out requirements that mandatory for Indian-flagged merchant vessels and foreign-flagged vessels trading in Indian coasts under specific period license. It is further recommended foreign-flagged vessels visiting Indian ports should be aware of this notice and may consider implementing the same criteria. Vessel owners, ISM managers in coordination with the master will need to conduct a comprehensive assessment to identify and create a design plan for CCTV systems. This will need to take into account vessel-specific vulnerabilities and optimal camera placement. This would include an assessment of potential areas crucial to safety and security, including the need to be intrinsically for tankers in hazardous zones. The notice includes recommendations on the locations, number of, and functions of cameras placed on vessels. It also has recommended specifications of CCTV cameras and equipment, control and monitoring stations, as well as training and maintenance procedures. You can read the full notice at iamsindia.in. For our next report, the American Bureau of Shipping and Monohuckabee Technology Institute, MTI, have successfully completed a landmark collaboration advancing the development of fully autonomous vessels. The Action Planning and Execution System, APXS Auto, Maritime Autonomy Framework from MTI received approval in principle from ABS. The project utilized the System Theoretic Process Analysis, STPA, method, an innovative hazard analysis technique. The collaboration between ABS and MTI arrives at a crucial juncture as the International Maritime Organization progresses with the development of regulations for maritime autonomous surface ships. As the maritime industry increasingly integrates advanced systems in the design of autonomous functions, the successful application of STPA within the APXS Auto framework marks a significant advancement in realizing the potential of autonomous shipping. ABS is collaborating with the industry, government regulators and stakeholders in the design and implementation of the world's most advanced remote control and autonomous technology. Up next, the Indian Ministry of Ports, Shipping and Waterways is focused on strengthening India's maritime sector, with ongoing projects worth 2 trillion rupees, almost $23 billion, and has set a goal to complete at least 150 projects by September 2025. One of the major goals is to make India one of the top 5 shipbuilding nations by 2047, with plans to expand shipbuilding capacity by adding 4 million gross registered tonnage. To support this ambition, policies and skill development initiatives are being formulated, with increased collaboration between the central and state governments. The ministry has also laid out a roadmap for a greener, more sustainable shipping industry. This includes the establishment of the Bharat Container Shipping Line under the Shipping Corporation of India and the development of a coastal green shipping corridor, beginning with the Kandla-Tuticorin route. Additionally, the Harbourcraft Green Transition Programme aims to encourage clean energy adoption across Indian ports. Within the next 3 months, all major ports will be required to tender for at least one green tug, further supporting the push for sustainability. For further information on the investment, visit iimsindia.in. In our next story, Guard P&I Club has issued a notice for operators about hazardous containerized cargo leakage and presents key measures to prevent these situations from escaping control. The club continues to see concerning cases of leakage from hazardous containerized cargoes, incidents which can quickly escalate into serious safety and environmental threats. Ensuring that crew and company personnel ashore understand the importance of swift action is essential to prevent these situations from spiraling out of control. You can find out Guard's recommended measures at guard.no/insights. For our next report, the American Bureau of Shipping has released guidance on an update to International Code for the Safe Carriage of Grain in Bulk, which is set to take effect on the 1st of January 2026. The IMO Maritime Safety Committee adopted a new resolution at its 108th session in May 2024, which includes amendments to the Grain Code. A new class of loading conditions for special compartments, which are defined as specially suitable compartment, partly filled in way of the hatch opening, with ends untrimmed, is introduced. This definition refers to a compartment that is not filled to the maximum extent possible in way of the hatch opening but is filled to a level equal with or above the bottom edge of the hatch end beams and has not been trimmed outside the periphery of the hatch opening by the provisions of Regulation A/10.4 of the Grain Code. In such compartments, the bulk grain shall be filled to a level equal with or above the bottom edge of the hatch end beams but may be at its natural angle of repose outside the periphery of the hatch opening. After loading, only the free grain surface in way of the hatch opening shall be level. A compartment may qualify for this classification if it is specially suitable as defined in Regulation A/2.7 of the Grain Code, in which case dispensation may be granted from trimming the ends of that compartment. Additional amendments in Part B of the Grain Code addressing calculation assumptions have also been made to provide guidance on the assumed slope of the cargo when partly filled in way of the hatch opening with ends untrimmed, for the purpose of determining the assumed volumetric heeling moment. The amendments will enter into force on January 1, 2026. They will apply to both new and existing ships that transport grain in bulk, under the newly defined set of loading conditions, starting from that date. You can read the key changes through our website. Next, the Liberia Maritime Authority has released a marine notice on how to deal with asbestos on board all ships that are in service, under repair, modification, conversion and alteration. Guidance is also provided on the prohibition of the use or storage of extinguishing media containing perfluorooctane sulfonic acid on new vessels and the requirement to remove PFOS on existing vessels. This notice applies to all ships, including mobile offshore units and high-speed craft. It breaks down its guidance of management of asbestos-containing materials on board ships certified under SOLAS into separate categories, including ships built before 1 July 2002, ships built on or after 1 July 2002 and before 1 January 2011, and ships built on or after 1 January 2011. Ships under 500 gross tons should manage ACMRs as far as practicable in accordance with the provisions above. You can download the notice at liscr.com/online library. Next, the Nautical Institute is proud to support the Maritime Technologies Forum's initiative in developing the guidelines for developing and implementing a safety management system for ammonia-fueled ships. This document is a critical first step in addressing safety gaps associated with the use of ammonia as a marine fuel, providing industry stakeholders with a structured approach to integrating safety measures within their safety management systems. As the maritime industry transitions toward alternative fuels, safety remains a paramount concern. Ammonia, while a promising zero-carbon fuel, presents unique operational challenges that must be managed effectively. The MTF guidelines serve as an essential resource for shipping companies, enabling them to develop or enhance existing SMS frameworks to ensure the safe application of ammonia as fuel on board vessels. The methodology used in these guidelines aligns with the ISM Code's Part A, identifying relevant safety considerations and incorporating insights from industry stakeholders to create a robust and practical tool. Find out more at the Nautical Institute's website. And for our final report, the UK Marine Accident Investigation Branch has launched an investigation after oil tanker Stena Immaculate and cargo vessel Solon went up in flames when the cargo ship crashed into the tanker near the Humber estuary in the UK on Monday, 10th of March. The fire forced all 23 crew of the Stena Immaculate to abandon ship. Of the 14 crew members of the Solon, only 13 made it back to shore, with the search for the final sailor called off on the assumption he was killed in the incident. The MAIB released a statement on the collision, which says, "The Marine Accident Investigation Branch was notified of the collision of the Portuguese-registered container ship Solon and the US-registered oil tanker Stena Immaculate in the North Sea 14 nautical miles northeast of Spurnhead at the entrance to the River Humber. MAIB immediately deployed a team of inspectors to Grimsby to begin a preliminary assessment. MAIB has since been joined by representatives from the US National Transportation Safety Board, the US Coast Guard and Marine Safety Investigation Authority Portugal. Having consulted with those flag state authorities, agreement has been made that the Marine Accident Investigation Branch will lead the safety investigation, with Portugal and the United States acting as substantially interested states. The priority has been to allow the emergency services the time to undertake search and rescue operations, secure the vessels and assess the environmental impact. While this work has been ongoing, MAIB's inquiries have focused on gathering witness accounts and obtaining digital data. Once it is safe to do so, MAIB will conduct a detailed inspection of both vessels and manage the retrieval of the voyage data recorders, VDR, from both vessels. The purpose of the MAIB investigation will be to establish the cause of events that led to this tragic accident, understand why it happened, and make recommendations to prevent similar accidents recurring. From the initial inquiries made, it is known that Solon frequently travelled between Grangemouth and Rotterdam and regularly used the route it took on the day of the collision. On Monday morning at 01:30 UTC, Solon passed to the east of the Longston Lighthouse and altered course onto a heading of approximately 150 degrees at a speed of about 16.4 knots. At 09:47 UTC, it struck the Stena Immaculate that was at anchor off the entrance to the River Humber. 36 crew from both vessels were recovered, but tragically one member of crew from Solon remains unaccounted for. As well as continuing to gather witness accounts, further investigation work will look to establish the navigational practices on board both vessels, the manning and fatigue management, the condition and maintenance of the vessels involved, and the environmental conditions at the time. That's all we have for this month. Thanks for listening.